نهاري دونكم ليل وليلي كله.
In the name of Allah, the Beneficent, the Merciful. My God, who can have tasted the sweetness of your love, then wanted another in place of you? Who can have become intimate with your nearness, then sought removal from you? My God, place us with him whom you have chosen for your nearness and your friendship, purified for your affection and your love, given yearning for the meeting with you, made pleased with your decree, granted gazing upon your face, shown the favor of your good pleasure, given refuge from separation from you and your loathing, settled in a sure sitting place in your neighborhood, singled out for true knowledge of you, made worthy for worship of you, whose heart you have captivated with your will, whom you have picked for contemplating you, whose look you have made empty for you, whose breast you have freed for your love, whom you have made desirous of what is with you, inspired with your remembrance, allotted thanksgiving to you, occupied with obeying you, turned into one of your righteous creatures, chosen for whispered prayer to you, and from whom you have cut off all things which cut him off from you.
وفي طلب الرضا منكم له الغايات تتفق
أبيث سادتي صبا
يذوب بكم وينمحق
وفي طلب الرضا منكم له الغايات تتفق
أن العبد الفقير أنا غرامي
على ما. Welcome back, dear listeners, in continuation to what we were saying, which was, of course, the aspects of how and what there is within us that can help strengthen our servitude to Allah, our ubudiyah. Of course, we had talked about how the verses of the Holy Quran can give us a beautiful glimpse as to what we can do and how we can build ourselves so that we are able to enhance our ubudiyah, our servitude, our worship, and our obedience to Allah. There's another very beautiful verse in the Holy Quran, in the word of Allah, which can be found in chapter Zumar, which is chapter number 39. And within this chapter number 39, we find verse number 56. Here it talks about the Day of Judgment, and it says, "Alas for me, for what I fell short of my duty to Allah." Now here we find that the Holy Quran, at least in its apparent meanings and its very clear meanings, has shown us that on the Day of Judgment, we will all feel that we fell short of the duty that we had as regards to Allah. Meaning, we will see that there was so much more we could have done when it comes to our worship or our obedience, or there is so much that we could have done as far as our servitude to Allah, our ubudiyah to Allah. And so when we come into this kind of frame of mind and we come into this kind of thought process that, well, I could have done so much more, this motivates you to do so much more. This motivation to do so much more, of course, helps us to increase our ubudiyah. It helps us to increase our servitude to Allah and our obedience to Allah. And even if we look at our own daily life, we will find that there are many times that we can do so much more. We find ourselves at times wasting our time with things which will be of no benefit to us. But on the other hand, if we have a Qur'ani view, if we look through the lens of the Qur'an, we will find that not only is our time incredibly valuable, but we should spend our time on things which are valuable primarily for the hereafter.
IRIB English Radio.
Our website is parstoday.com.
أجب دعائي يا رجائي للرضا والخير أنر طريقي مع صديقي باحترام الخير.
And now we invite you to listen to Sheikh Hamza Yusuf.
اعترفوا بأنهم ملكه وعبيده. They finally admit that they are in the dominion. They admit in this, when the calamity comes, they admit we are the dominion of God. Inna lillahi, we belong to God. In other words, if I take something, if I take this, if I owned it, and I took it and threw it out, and you say, you can't do that. Why can't I do that? This is mine. I own it. I can do whatever I want with it. That's the nature of property. Property is that the one who owns it has the right to do what he wills with it. That's the nature of property. If you don't have that quality of possession, then it's not really your property. Now, because the dunya is not our property, we can't do whatever we want with it, can we? But we understand the concept of property. This world is the dominion of God, and therefore God can do whatever he wants with it. Now, the nature of, you see, if I have a book and I burn it, and you say to me, you can't do that. Yes, I can. It's my book, and I want to burn it. You shouldn't burn books. Maybe I shouldn't, but I can, and you can't stop me by law. So then if the person asks you, why did you burn the book? Because there's mistakes in it. Oh, I didn't realize. Now I've explained myself, and now it makes sense to you. This is Musa and Al-Khidr, right? In that story of Al-Kahf, which is the story of the problem of evil. That story solves the problem of evil. Because Musa is looking with the eye of the outward and everything he sees is wrong. But when it's explained to him by a servant who was given knowledge of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, suddenly the servant, the Musa is saying, I didn't realize. Now I have an explanation. Well, what happens on Yawm al-Qiyamah? Allah tells us in the Quran, he explains it all to us. And then everybody's going to say, now it makes sense. The difference between the believer and the kafir is in this world we're saying we know it makes sense and we're willing to wait until the day of judgment to have it explained. Because we trust Allah. They're saying no, it's wrong. How do you know? You don't have all the information. You cannot make a judgment about a thing unless you understand that thing. Al-hukmu ala shay'in far'un an tasawwurihi. To judge a thing is only one aspect of conceptualizing the entirety of that thing. It's a principle in logic. And that's why a judge has to know all the facts. If you prejudge, it's called prejudice. And it's considered to be a moral vice, to be prejudiced.
Thank you very much, dear listeners, for listening to this episode of Foresight. Don't forget to visit our website at parstoday.com. Until another episode and another great tip, fi amanillah, and God bless you all.
Ya Fuad. سوى الله فوض الأمر لله لله قل ونادي حسبي الله قل فما خاب عبد دعا الله الله لا إله سوى لا تخالف.
Iranian Radio Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
Major U.S. arms companies accounted for no less than 54% of all weapon sales of the world's 100 biggest arms suppliers in 2020, according to a new report, the latest in an annual series published by the Stockholm International Peace Research Institute. In this regard, we have prepared an article for you written by Jim Love, writer. This article is published under the heading, U.S. Weapons Industry Continues to Thrive During the Pandemic. Stay tuned for more. Major U.S. arms companies accounted for no less than 54% of all weapon sales of the world's 100 biggest arms suppliers in 2020, according to a new report, the latest in an annual series published by the Stockholm International Peace Research Institute. The report noted that the new total, an increase of 17% over 2015 sales, marked the sixth year in a row of growth in arms sales. Despite pressure on many countries to divert already strained budgets to deal with the COVID-19 pandemic, as well as the subsequent global recession, sales of arms and military services by the 100 biggest companies increased by 1.3% compared to 2019 and totaled $531 billion, according to the report. The report noted that the new deal, an increase of 17% over 2015 sales, marked the sixth year in a row of growth in arms sales. 2015 was the first year in which companies were included in what CIPRI refers to as the top 100. According to Alexandra Marksteiner, researcher with the CIPRI Military Expenditure and Arms Production Program, the industry giants were largely shielded by sustained government demand for military goods and services. In much of the world, military spending grew and some governments even accelerated payments to the arms industry in order to mitigate the economic impact of the COVID-19 crisis. As in the recent past, U.S. companies dominated the top ranks. Lockheed Martin Corp. ranked number one, followed by Raytheon Technologies, Boeing, Northrop Grumman Corps, and General Dynamics Corps. Together, those five top companies accounted for more than $180 billion in sales during 2020, or about one-third of all sales by the biggest 100 companies. 36 other U.S. companies included on the list added another $100 billion in sales, bringing the total U.S. share to $285 billion, a 1.9% increase over 2019's total. Led by British companies that together sold $37.5 billion in 2020, 26 European arms companies that made the list accounted for 21% of total arms sales, or $109 billion. That marked an increase of 6.2% over 2019. Britain's BAE Systems, which ranked sixth overall behind the big five U.S. companies, accounted for $24 billion, or nearly two-thirds of the Europe's share, while French company arms sales actually fell by 7.7% compared to 2019. Sales by the four German in the top 100 increased by 1.3% over the year, reaching nearly $9 billion, or 1.7% of total sales. Russian companies, on the other hand, suffered some of the sharpest drops in sales, in part due to delays in delivery schedules caused in major part of the pandemic. The Zionist regime was followed by the five listed Japanese companies that together sold $9.9 billion worth of military goods and services, and by the four listed South Korean firms, whose combined sales came to $6.5 billion.
Hello, I'm Mubarak Kenya, and a big welcome to this week's edition of Africa Today.
Stay tuned with Africa Today.
Africa Today.
United States Secretary of State visited Africa last November, where he witnessed the decline of his country's influence in Africa. During Blinken's three-nation Africa tour, there were protests across the world against Washington's interference in Ethiopia. Here is one such protest outside the U.S. Embassy in Pretoria, South Africa.
It's an issue of the country. And we don't need America to interfere in Ethiopia's issue. Actually, we don't need any support. America must stay away. USA must stay away from the issue of Ethiopia.
Hello, I'm Mubarak Kenya, and a warm welcome to Africa Today, a weekly program that gives you an alternative view of events making headlines in Africa. Today, we are focusing on the recent visit to Africa by U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken. This visit took place against the backdrop of declining U.S. influence in the continent and growing anti-U.S. sentiments among the people of Africa. In the second part of our program, we shall look at eNaira, Nigeria's and Africa's first digital currency. We are asking, how are the common people in Nigeria benefiting from this digital currency? And will other African countries launch similar currencies?
U.S. influence declining in Africa. U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken visited Kenya, Nigeria, and Senegal last November, where he saw firsthand the decline of this country's influence in Africa. All these three countries have close and excellent economic and political ties with China. In a message that reflected an awareness of a regional power game with China, Blinken said the U.S. would no longer treat Africa a mere pawn in the global competition with other powers.
Now, speaking at a joint press conference with Blinken, Nigeria's foreign minister refuted unfounded accusations by the U.S. and Western media's hype about a so-called debt trap caused by China's proposed Belt and Road Initiative that seeks to develop new trade routes connecting China with the rest of the world.
We try to be extremely prudent in this. We don't just, you know, borrow willy-nilly. And in fact, in reality, our debt-to-GDP ratio is still actually very good. So it's sustainable debt, and that we focus on, and we keep our eyes very much on that. But the reality also, you know, is that the government realized, Mr. President realized that to industrialize, we just have to get the infrastructure in place.
Now, for more on Blinken's visit to Africa, we contacted Farah Maalim, a Kenyan politician and lawyer. He's also a former deputy speaker of Kenyan Parliament. Now, we first asked Mr. Maalim his opinion on some of the objectives pursued by U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken during his visit to Africa, and if he actually achieved what he wanted.
My view is that he has just come to promote a partisan, partial agenda to assist the TPLF to make it easier for them to take over power. The idea was exactly the same way as what they did to Mengistu Haile Mariam last time when TPLF was taking over power, and to push them into some kind of a false sense of negotiation, which will then allow gives them the opportunity for them to mobilize themselves, to create despondency, fear, and panic in the population, and make it easier for TPLF to take over the country.
The decline of American influence in Africa has been evident for some years, especially during Trump's presidency. Over the recent months, President Joe Biden has prompted an America is back narrative intended to signal a U.S. return to the international arena and institutions renounced by his predecessor. The decline of U.S. influence has been worsened by heightened anti-American feelings amongst Africans. These Ethiopian anti-U.S. demonstrators outside the U.S. Embassy in Pretoria, South Africa, are clearly fed up with Washington's imperialism.
America and U.S. friends, stop supporting the terrorist group, and now it's time for Africa to unite and free Africa! Free!
Will Blinken's visit lead to Washington's increased interference in Africa's internal affairs in a bid to halt its declining influence in the continent?
Meddling in Africa for the Americans has been the order of the day. And they're doing it not for the interests of Africans, but they're doing it for their own interests. And their own interests basically dictate for them to lay their hands on the resources of Africa. When a country becomes a failed state like DRC Congo, it's easier for them to pull out of that country every day $500 million worth of minerals and natural resources, and nobody's going to question them because there's no government, there's no viable government to make them accountable for their actions. So, and that's how they want it. They do it in Somalia today. The planes that leave Mogadishu Airport every night at 3 o'clock, not a single Somali, not a minister, not a president, not a head of the security intelligence there, nobody knows what they're taking out of that place. They did that with Balitogle, where there was next to it to a mountain. Everybody knows they were moving the uranium out of that place. They're doing a lot of work in Somalia, taking things that nobody knows what it is. So basically, they want this country to be failed state so that it's easier for them to start moving and transporting and cutting away the gold, the uranium, the coltan, the manganese, the everything, the gas in the final analysis, because the Horn of Africa is endowed with the biggest deposits of natural resources in the world.
Africa has witnessed tremendous transformation over the past decade as most countries in the continent have adopted a look-east policy after failing to develop, especially in terms of infrastructure, despite close ties with Western powers. Mr. Maalim gives us here his take on why the United States is witnessing a rapid decline of its power and influence in Africa.
Then, of course, the other countries that are coming up now, the Chinese have come up massively. The Russians are beginning to have certain influences also in Africa. I just hope they are also smart enough to avoid some of the pitfalls of their fellow and the fellow the Americans there, and after all, they have to be very careful because the other races will not see such a big racial difference between the Russians and the Americans. Of course, there's a history, a powerful history, which is very different. I mean, it was an egalitarian society, which was embedded or basically founded on socialist ideals. They just have to be very careful the countries where they go into. I'm talking about the Russians. But the Russians are coming up, and many countries in Africa are willing to welcome the Russians. The Turks are making an impression and a big difference in Africa right now. And they're increasing what you call their influence in Africa. And I have a feeling that it's going to be much more phenomenal and bigger than it is today. So America has lost. The West has lost.
At the last stop of his three-nation trip to Africa, U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken claimed that there will be a fresh investment in Senegal without saddling countries with unimaginable debts. While Blinken did not directly accuse China, U.S. media said his debt talk is clearly aimed at the China-proposed Belt and Road Initiative. This is while African intellectuals have rejected the U.S. accusation on China's engagement with Africa.
But China's investment, I wouldn't consider it as a debt trap because China has the kind of negotiating position where it would like, number one, to look into the success of the BRI because many of these projects are part and parcel of the BRI.
The multiple effect is that it is creating a value chain. You have in distributors, you have in other key players, apart from direct jobs. For the first time in the history of Africa, we have a partner that is both willing and able. So what is needed is for us to meet the Chinese at the middle, and both of us can walk the long walk of getting Africa, you know, fulfill its manifest destiny.
Mr. Maalim talked about the rise of China in Africa. So we asked him to elaborate on the reason why many African countries prefer having trade and infrastructure projects with China as opposed to the United States.
Any negotiation, economic negotiation between America, Europe, and third world countries is one that is only a continuation of colonization and basically to use both the human and the natural resources of those countries to advantage for eternity. And that cannot be allowed. Those things are just stopped. Now Africa is going to develop with the people who are willing to invest their money in, but on equal and respectable terms, like the Chinese and in some cases the Turks and other countries, like the Indians, they're willing also to do the same. The Russians, I expected them to do much better than they're doing now. But you can rest assured, we are through as a continent with Western imperialism. We are through with that. We don't want any more of it. And the more you get out of it, like Magufuli did before his life came to an end, he had a short period of time, but he did so much for that country that everybody wants to do the same now.
Now, while in Senegal, Blinken warned a Russian military company to stop its involvement in Mali. Now, these arrogant remarks came while Mali officially invited the Russian security company to assist in combating Takfiri terrorists.
Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov has said the company has a legitimate right to be in Mali because it was invited by the transitional government. Speaking during a meeting with Lavrov in Moscow mid-November, Mali's Foreign Minister Abdoulaye Diop said Russia has always been with this country in difficult times.
Whenever Mali has been in difficult situations since our independence, Russia has always been with us. Today we are in a difficult situation and we're still turning to this friend so that they can help us out.
Where does the U.S. get the audacity to order around African countries on their internal affairs and relations with other world powers?
They got their way around with Africa the way they wanted it. God knows for how many decades. And how many decades before that as the colonies of the Western countries? How many decades before that as a source of slaves for their own economies in Europe and in all the Americas? And later on, neo-colonialism, as we have been experiencing for the last 70 years. So basically, you know, you become so audacious. You talk carelessly. I think, you know, you're so what you call absorbed in your own perception of the power you have, that you think you can order everybody around. It's absolute nonsense. Nonsense. And I'm there. Because the French are taking away the Mali gold. And if they can bring in the Russians to get rid of this French, because the French have been creating a revolution or a coup in every West African country.
Now, despite claims of support for the advancement of democracy, the United States and indeed other Western powers continue to support totalitarian regimes in Africa and elsewhere as long as they serve their imperialist and domineering interests. Now, many Africans are now questioning if Westerners really mean what they say about democracy. Mr. Malim gives his take.
So they don't care. They don't care for democracy. They don't care for human rights. They are, you know, deep down, terrible racists who believe that we're no more than better than what they call the animals in the jungle up there. So this is the reality of life. And we, America, which is supposed to be the biggest democracy right now, and the black man is every day fighting for equality. And then you tell me that that's a country to emulate, that's a country to come to us here and tell us how we should live. No, we lost the we stopped, you know, keeping our eyes on the prize. At the time of independence of the struggle, we should have ended the relationship with those countries way back.
Very well put there. How can Washington lecture Africans on democracy and human rights while African Americans face oppression and institutional racism across the U.S.? Thanks for that, Mr. Malim, a former Deputy Speaker of Kenya's National Assembly. Let's now take a short break, and when we come back, we shall look at Nigeria's first digital currency. So stay with us.
Naira, Nigeria's first digital currency.
You're listening to Africa Today. Africa Today is an analytical weekly review of political, economic, and social events in Africa, the world's second largest continent. The series is broadcast every week on Saturdays and Sundays by IRIB English Radio.
Last October, Nigeria became the first African country to introduce a digital currency. During the launch of the currency, Nigerian President Muhammadu Buhari noted that Nigeria is also one of the earliest countries in the world to introduce a digital currency to its citizens. He said digital currencies could foster economic growth.
And its sister agencies, like the Nigerian Communications Commission, integration of banking software across the country, and painstaking tests to ensure the robustness, safety, and scalability of the central bank digital currencies system.
Well, Godwin Omfiele, governor of the Central Bank of Nigeria, says the e-Naira is the digital equivalent of the physical Naira, the country's currency. Many Nigerians have generally welcomed the new digital currency, but say there is need to further educate the public on its use. Let's take a listen.
I think it's a very good policy, but the thing, from the feelings we are getting, many people don't know much about it, so there is still room to engage people to get to know so that they will participate actively.
Well, for more on the e-Naira launch, we contacted Amin Yusuf, the co-founder of Afrobytes, an international tech marketplace that connects African tech industry with the media, business, and technology leaders, policy experts, and investors. Now, we first asked Mr. Yusuf to tell us how the e-Naira digital currency is doing since its launch.
Hard to say that. The launch was just 1 month ago, last month, so it's pretty new.
to draw conclusions about this e-currency. But what we can see from now is that it's quite stable because it's between 0.0021 and 0.0022 euros. So the parity is quite good. It's quite stable.
While there are millions of young people in Nigeria who are techno-savvy or digital natives, a huge segment of the country's population needs to be trained on how to make use of the e-Naira and e-transactions. A Nigerian reacting to the launch of the digital currency says there is need for inclusivity.
And again, so that we're not creating a product for very few people in the society. We're creating a product that will run across because we have quite a number of people at the bottom of the pyramid who needs to be included.
Will e-Naira benefit the ordinary Nigerians, especially small-scale business owners?
Well, first we have to remember that the e-Naira is just a digital form of the Naira. So if the Naira is not stable, the e-Naira won't be stable. And there is a question of the confidence. Do people have more trust in Naira than in e-Naira, or the contrary? The fact is that those two currencies are the same. So there is a question of trust for the adoption. For sure, it's more practical, it's digital, there is a lot of benefits that are like just electronic. But to get access to the use of that, you have to have an e-Naira wallet, you have to do a KYC, you have to do a long process before being able to use it.
Speaking during the launch of the Central Bank of Nigeria digital currency, otherwise known as e-Naira, and its underlying technology called blockchain, President Buhari was upbeat that it would increase Nigeria's GDP.
Alongside digital innovations, central bank digital currencies can foster economic growth through better economic activities. Indeed, some estimates indicate that the adoption of central bank digital currencies and its underlying technology called blockchain can increase Nigeria's GDP by $29 billion United States dollars over the next 10 years.
We asked Mr. Yusuf his opinion on the e-Naira's contribution to Nigeria's economic growth in the long term.
There is an estimation of $29 billion dollar contribution to the GDP. That's the numbers. But it's just 1 month, so it's kind of hard to draw conclusions. The only thing we can say for sure is that e-Naira is less costly, it's more efficient. They want to make it generally acceptable, safe, and trusted as a means of payment. But that's, as I said previously, that's just Naira. So what is important here is to understand that it provides the stability of Naira, no more, no less.
There was apprehension across Nigeria after the American tech giant Google briefly removed the e-Naira from Play Store after over 100,000 users had downloaded it. Now, this has raised concerns about the vulnerability of African countries that rely on foreign platforms for critical ICT needs.
Professor Elijah Bitange Ndemo, a Kenyan ICT champion and academician, gives here his opinion on what Africa needs to do to avoid pitfalls inherent in over-reliance on Western tech giants.
Now, tell me, I am not being bad to say a country like Botswana, 1 million. What would it tell Americans that we don't want Google here because they would say to hell with you? But if AU stood up and said we don't want this 1.2 billion people, they would listen to you. They would listen to you. So we need to create a mega single market to have leverage in terms of discussions. Otherwise, now we are just slaves like we were when we were colonized first.
The e-Naira app extensively relies on foreign platforms, including Google's Play Store, which pulled down this app. So what needs to be done to stop reliance on foreign IT platforms?
the only solution to stop relying on a foreign IT platform would be to create our own. But the problem is the penetration after the adoption. Basically, that's the same problem for so many countries around the globe. Whether you are in France or Italy or Nigeria, that's the same. You have to deal with Google, Facebook, Microsoft, sometimes some Asian companies. So there is a problem of independence here, but that's not specific to Nigeria. That's globally that we have this problem.
In Africa, nations from Ghana to South Africa are testing digital forms of their legal tender to allow for faster and cheaper money transactions without losing control over their monetary systems.
So, what is the future of eNaira, and will other African countries launch a similar digital currencies in future?
What is interesting with the eNaira is that first, it's an innovation. We have to remind that it is an innovation, and it will respond to a lot of questions. First, do countries able to propose an alternative to the cryptocurrency model? Because as I said, this is a new currency, that's not a cryptocurrency, that's very different. We know who is the owner of the eNaira. You don't know exactly who is the owner of a digital currency. There is no, it's not anonymous first. So the question is basically, do the general public believe in the currency of a country, whatever its form is, whether it's physical or digital? So what is interesting at the same time is that it's an innovation. I think there is a curve here of learning. Probably Nigeria authority will have to adapt along the way. They will get experience. So that's still interesting. And I think that even if we can't say what will happen in 1 year or 2 years or 10 years from now, it's an interesting move for sure.
Mr. Yusuf there says that the eNaira is a great innovation, but we still have to wait and see how it turns out in the coming months and years. Well, that brings us to the end of this week's edition of Africa Today. We do welcome your comments through our social media handle. It was great having you, and goodbye for now, and God bless you.
Stories from the past. Stories from the lives of the infallibles. Stories from different parts of the world. On the Lantern.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In the name of Allah, the most compassionate, the most merciful. Dear friends, salam, and welcome to this episode of Lantern. As usual, we start with an interesting story. Beware of the hypocrites. This is the title of today's story. Once a fox was roaring in a forest searching for food. As to his bad luck, he got caught up in a trap. He tried his best to get free, but lost his tail in the struggle. He felt very small. Thinking that now every fox would laugh at him, he felt so sad that he thought of committing suicide. But then he said to himself, "It is cowardice to kill oneself. I should think of something else." At last, the fox planned to pursue all the foxes to part with their tails. So he called a meeting of all the foxes and said, "We should get rid of our tails, and they are heavy, ugly, and tiresome." Though he tried to divert the attention of all the foxes from his tail-less appearance, one clever fox noticed it and said, "Sir, you wouldn't have given us this advice if you weren't tailless, isn't it?" So we say, hypocrisy seldom works. Dr. Fakhr Rohani.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim wa bin istain. In this episode, we are going to be concerned with the problem of hypocrisy. As you know, and as all of us have noticed, in all communities, we find some people who say something but behave in another way. For example, we may know some people who may express the interest and attention to us, but at the same time, we sense that they are not sincere. This insincerity, this practical insincerity, is of course an instance of hypocrisy. And this hypocrisy is regarded as a sin in Islamic teachings. And those people who were hypocrites in the early Islamic history, they harmed the Muslim community quite a lot. I mean, apparently, they were Muslims, but secretly they kept and at times they reinforced the connections and secret connections and relations with the polytheists and with the enemies of the Islamic religion. According to the Islamic sources and Islamic history, we find that those people who pretended to be believers, but in fact they were not, as believers as they claimed, they harmed the Islamic history, Islamic teachings, and the whole course of Islamic civilization, generally speaking. They have harmed the course of Islamic civilization much more than the harms received from non-Muslims and polytheists. Because when a person is a polytheist, because when someone doesn't believe in the Islamic religion and comes to you, you understand that, okay? You know that, okay? This person doesn't believe in the Islamic religion. So I know what to do with him, and I know on which basis do I have to talk with him. How should I approach him, okay? How should I answer his or her questions and so on? Or when someone believes in another religion, for example, when someone is Christian, is Jews or Assyrian or Buddhist or any other religion, you know that, well, he or she does have a certain religious basis or religious background. So when you want to approach him or her or answer him or her, and transactions and so on, okay, you know that, okay, that person isn't Muslim. For example, let's say he's a Christian. Or for example, he's a Jew. Okay, no problem. Okay, it's up to him or her. Okay, whichever religion he or she may prefer to have. Okay. On the other hand, I do know that I'm a true Muslim. I'm a Muslim, and I have, a certain set of duties and obligations to consider in approaching, in transacting with other people. But when someone pretends to be a Muslim, but in fact he isn't a Muslim, not only is he an indifferent person, but also he's very much active on the opposite line, on the opposite front, okay? And this happened in the early Islamic history.
Under the light of lantern, we'll look at the story which indicates a moral aspect of our life.
There were some people in Medina who pretended to be Muslims. Okay, they were, some of them, were among the companions of the Prophet Muhammad, because day and night they didn't lose any opportunity of being with the Prophet Muhammad sallallahu alaihi wasallam. They didn't lose this opportunity not for the sake of receiving any grace from being associated with the Prophet Muhammad sallallahu alaihi wasallam. Rather, they wanted to collect information and obtain some intelligence, secret information, and wanted to convey and pass on those secret informations to the polytheists of Mecca, who were still among the opponents of the Prophet Muhammad. And for example, in some battles that took place in the lifetime of the Prophet Muhammad, for example, in the Battle of the Trench, Harb al-Khandaq, Ghazwat al-Khandaq, we find that there were some people who secretly communicated with the Jews, and some of the Jews, even Jews of Medina, apparently they were confederates of the Prophet Muhammad sallallahu alaihi wasallam due to a pact earlier concluded between them and the Prophet Muhammad. Yet they kept the secret relations with the Meccan polytheists, and we find that this kind of hypocrisy harmed the Muslim community quite a lot. Now we find that this hypocrisy have certain characteristics, certain traits. There's a Quranic surah in the Holy Quran, Surah Al-Munafiqun. We find that in this surah, some aspects or some main moral traits of moral indications and moral traits of the hypocrites are indicated. In one of them is simply that the hypocrites say something, but they seldom believe in what they say, or they don't believe in what they say. Yes, apparently they say that, okay, they are Muslims, but in fact they are still non-Muslim, they are still a polytheist, or simply a non-Muslim. Another one is that hypocrites pretend to be helpers of Muslims, but in fact they try to harm the Muslim community and the Islamic religion and each and every Muslim they interact with. The effect of this is that apparently they come to help you, but in fact they make more problems for you.
That was all for today. Thank you very much for joining us. Inshallah, we continue this topic on the next episode. Till then, may Allah bless all of you. Fi amanallah. Ala bi dhikrillahi
tatma'innul qulub. This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
the limelight.
The Zionist regime's PM praised the execution of a Palestinian who was lying on the ground by paramilitary police near Damascus Gate in Al-Quds. In this regard, we have prepared an article for you written by Maureen Claire Morphy, journalist. This article is published under the heading Bennett Blesses Street Executions of Palestinians. Stay tuned for more. Naftali Bennett praised the execution of a Palestinian who was lying on the ground by paramilitary police near Damascus Gate in Al-Quds recently. The Zionist regime prime minister gave the officers his full backing. Bennett said, "That is how our forces are expected to act, and that is how they acted." Bennett's comments demonstrate his commitment to the Zionist regime's shoot-to-kill policy against Palestinians that intensified during the last several years of his predecessor Benjamin Netanyahu's tenure. After a streak of street executions of suspected Palestinian attackers in late 2015, the Israeli human rights group B'Tselem blamed Netanyahu for the transformation of police officers and even of armed civilians into judges and executions. The shooting death of Muhammad Salima, 25, as he lay on the ground and posed no immediate danger, generated unusual controversy over the execution of a Palestinian after eyewitnesses' video circulated online. That 23-second video, recorded from a bystander's vehicle, shows two Zionist border police officers firing at Salima from a distance as he lay on the ground and posed no threat to anyone's life. A 50-second video clip was later released by the Zionist regime police showing the events leading up to Salima's execution. The Zionist regime releases such footage when it thinks it bolsters its narrative of events, but in countless other cases, such as the execution of Iyad Halak in Al-Quds last year, it prevents video from being made public. The video released by the Zionist regime police appears to show Salima walking across the street. The Zionist regime police video also shows at least three other armed Israeli regime officers quickly arriving on the scene. The man allegedly stabbed sustained moderate to severe wounds, according to Israeli regime media. The Zionist regime forces operate under a confirm the kill policy exposed in a military court hearing following the 2004 shooting death of a 13-year-old Iman al-Hams by troops in southern Gaza. More than a decade later, that horrific practice generated widespread outcry after a video published by B'Tselem showed the Zionist regime army medic Ilor Azaria shooting at a prone Palestinian in Al-Khalil. According to writer Richard Silverstein, Azaria had asked his commander for permission to confirm the kill before firing at Abd al-Fattah Yusri al-Sharif. Azaria served a 9-month prison sentence in what was at once